Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Welcome to another Global from Asia podcast, episode number 48. I just finished taking some baby photos, family photos with my son Miles. He turned 100 days old, and this is some milestone in Chinese culture, I think, for many years. This was is a big milestone for kids to turn 100 days old, so I'm pretty excited there. Couple quick announcements. Almost afraid to mention it publicly because I'm pretty overwhelmed, but I've been working on a book that's based on all these awesome experiences and people I've met on the show. It's going to be called Hong Kong Supercharged: Resources You Need to Get Started with a Hong Kong Business. It's jam-packed with value bombs on getting a Hong Kong company set up online, doing it yourself, merchant accounts, bank account setups, places to hang out and stay in Hong Kong. It's over 100 pages already. I'm really exhausted mentally. I've been working on it for a while and kind of finally feel like it's coming together enough to at least mention it. Also, the mastermind we've been talking about for a couple weeks now, got about 7 people together, and this first one's going to be today after this podcast is launched, and we are going to do it on Google Hangouts. It's a pretty exciting group of people, mostly in Asia, some people in Europe and the US, so we'll keep you guys posted on how that goes. This first one I'm going to host, and hope many more to come. Okay, and now for this week's show. I know last week we had part one of Fion talking about offshore BVIs and company setups in Hong Kong. I think it would be fun to take a little bit of a break from the corporate stuff and maybe get into some stories and case studies. We have a Kickstarter project, Spore Chargers, and there are 2 team members I met. They were here on their first trip to China to start sourcing and building the product after they're reaching their funding goal. I had a lot of fun meeting and talking to them and kind of give me a little bit of memory lane when I first came here and what they're going through. So let's listen in. Okay, thank you everybody for tuning in to another Global from Asia podcast. We're here in Futian District, Shenzhen, and we have some first-time visitors to China. We have David and Jason from the Spore Project. Thanks for being here, guys, today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely, man. Thank you.
Cool. So maybe you can quickly introduce yourselves and the project.
So I'm David Hunt from Charlotte, North Carolina. Went to school in Philadelphia with Jason, and this is Spore, where we manufacture solar-powered battery solutions, really, for devices.
Yeah, I would say systems might be a better word, but this is Jason. I'm from Atlantic City, New Jersey. Again, went to Drexel University with David, along with our other partner who we're out here with, named Mark. Together, plus our CTO back in the States, we're trying to make scalable solar solutions to charge devices and eventually, you know, make larger applications and systems, basically making solar energy, clean energy, more accessible.
And you guys had a successfully funded Kickstarter, and actually one of your backers, Marcel in Hong Kong, connected us, which is pretty awesome. And that's how we met. So thanks, Marcel. And so you've been in China now just what, like how long? And
about 2 weeks now. Yeah, we've been in Shenzhen for 2 weeks and be here for another week.
What do you guys think of China so far? Maybe just
I think it's great. A lot of differences in culture, in business, interpersonal interactions. It's a very crowded city, to say the least. And I think that density contributes a lot to no personal space bubbles, which is a very different thing in America. I think people pride themselves on having a personal space bubble, but it's definitely been a rewarding experience so far. I think in a lot of its differences, it's kind of made us step up to the plate to adapt to those differences and really buckle down and focus on what we're here for.
I would say it also just makes, I mean, this is the mecca for hardware manufacturing. So just even being in this city, you just get the sense and the feeling that anything is possible. So if you're an entrepreneur, if you're in a startup that makes something physical, this is a place that if you're not planning on being out here, I would start planning now, because it's an incredible environment to be in, an incredible atmosphere, just having all the components and pieces of any kind of product that might pop in your head, you know, down the street, just makes it that much more real. And everyone here is, you know, very ready and willing to talk about prices and get to the point. And that's something we like about the Chinese culture, you know, whereas in America, everything seems to be, you know, stretched out, elongated. You know, that's not how startups really operate. Whereas out here, the startup culture is much more aligned with kind of the Chinese way of doing business and getting things done, in the sense of, I need something, here it is, it's done, let's move forward, you know, kind of putting it together and then getting it out to the world. So this is our first experience in China. So it's, it's been a great experience so far, and I'm sure we'll be back.
I know you extended your trip, right, already? Yeah, that's what happened to me. So we'll see how it goes.
We'll be here for another 5 years.
Yeah, who knows? You never know. I never knew how long I would stay, so I'm still here. And so maybe you can just give us a little bit of idea how this came to be, how Spore started.
I guess this started in my head about 2 years ago, just working on larger solar projects, doing a lot of research. I was working with actually my mom's company, who was doing solar financing for larger scale projects. And I just had the idea that solar could be cheaper. And when I looked into it, the idea was, you know, solar at that time was getting cheaper, exponentially cheaper, and it really continues to get cheaper. The problem being there's few small scale applications for it, or people developing uses for it. So we took ready available technology like USB and battery technology, lithium battery technology, and essentially put a solar panel on it and put it in your pocket. So from that idea, it also kind of branched out from my experimentation with Arduinos and kind of small microcomputers like that. And with the idea that how are these things being powered, right? So if they don't consume that much power, like our devices don't consume that much power, LED lights don't consume that much power, Arduinos don't consume that much power, why do we have to plug them into our computer? Why do we have to plug them into, you know, substandard battery systems? Why can't we create something that generates enough energy to run indefinitely? And that's essentially the birth of Spore. And then the idea of just daisy chaining these things together, again, why can't batteries work together? Why can't I charge your battery? Why can't your battery charge mine? So again, it just comes down to creating like the most dynamic power supply possible and then strapping a self-regenerative capability on top of it. So it started out really just as like probably like a 1 or 2 watt solar panel with a small battery tied to the back of it. And as we geared towards Kickstarter as like, you know, a way to launch the product, it seemed that people were more interested in the battery. So we beefed up the battery, dropped the solar panel, and that's kind of how it took on the shape that it has today. And then, yeah, it's really just been a process of, all right, idea, product design, reproduct design, and then moving from there. So
cool. And I always like to know, like, how long, what would be some milestones? So a couple years ago, you thought of the idea. And then, of course, we all know about the Kickstarter. Maybe you can give us some ideas, especially for other entrepreneurs listening, like idea to maybe your main milestones that you could think about.
I can definitely talk about that. So I worked on this idea at a startup weekend, essentially, but it was Lean Startup Machine, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I did this for a Lean Startup Machine weekend in Philadelphia, and it ended up winning. And it was really just with like my MVP was quite literally, I walked down to Radio Shack, bought a battery, bought a solar panel and glued them together and was like, this is what it is, you know? And from the traction that I got from that, it really just gave me enough motivation to continue working on it. And then the next milestone, I would say, was really showing this to a product designer and saying, all right, make this for me in a way that I could sell, you know, I wouldn't just use it myself, but other people would buy it from me. And then once I fully saw it, it was kind of what it looks like today. And that for me, and then printing it out as a physical 3D printed prototype really was my milestone to keep me going, getting it physically in my hands. Because for a hardware product, like if it exists on a screen, it's really hard to put it in your head into someone's hand. But what a 3D printer allows you to do is then literally put it in your hand. And then from that, it kind of just got more rounded. It got more, you know, it slimmed down a lot and things like that. I think the next milestone was at our university, we had an incubator competition. So it was like a $10,000 prize, office space and stuff like that. So we applied for this thing, wrote a business plan, ended up joining this competition, and me and Dave gave a presentation and ended up winning the $10,000. So again, that kind of reinforced us to continue this. And then from that point, which I guess was October of 2013, we just pretty much worked on that exclusively, you know, whether it was in classes, like we both studied entrepreneurship and finance essentially. So all of our class projects were, we would superimpose Spore onto that and then use that class time to develop the idea even further. So by the time that we were ready for Kickstarter, we had a lot figured out as far as what did we really want to build, essentially, not just like from a product standpoint, but from a business standpoint, what were we all about kind of thing. We just had enough time to think about it. So I'd say the incubator competition was a huge milestone. And then obviously, like you said, the Kickstarter is clearly like the milestone.
And then I think a lot of people talk about the PR. Do you guys get the PR before the Kickstarter?
So on the PR standpoint, you get a significant amount before, but you also get a lot during, obviously, and after. The PR before is really based off of the quality of reach outs to different organizations before or prior to your campaign. And I think that's a huge point. I think one thing people get tripped up in is thinking that, you know, you make a great video and a great page and you expect it to sell itself. But I think it was on Wayne's World. There was this part where they're like, build it and people will come or something like that. But that's not the mantra of Kickstarter. You know, you gotta build it, refine it, market it, test it, market it, and keep going. So the partnerships we developed beforehand with our university, with different publications in the city of Philadelphia, even in our home cities from North Carolina to Atlantic City, really helped us on that initial push and getting relationships in the most important thing or most significant thing about the PR relationships prior to your Kickstarter is that they should be relevant and of quality, right? So we wouldn't go to a garment manufacturer or a garment publication and say, hey, like, we'd love for you to feature us because you could put Spore in your pocket. It's like, no, you got to go to the tech publications and the ecological friendly or ecological consciousness publications and say, here's where we can add value for you. And it was a very clear link having a hardware product, so it made it that much easier.
And I think for us as well, it made it a little bit more complicated, but also better because we had the tech, right? It's a battery charger. It charges technological devices. It had the solar, so you could kind of cater to the more environmentally conscious. So just right off the bat, you had two different kinds of blogs or two different kinds of publications and websites and networks to tap into. And then we also had this extra layer of essentially like do it yourself, 3D printing and more like hacker type cultures and those blogs as well. So I think in creating a Kickstarter campaign, that's something to think about, like not just have one outlet, but have kind of multiple layers of value so that people can pick it up from different channels essentially. And that's something that we got into as well. But that being said, it requires that much more preparation and that much more outreach and response too, because you're going to reach out to people and then they're going to say, oh, this is cool. Like, tell me more about it. Or could you send me a press release, or can you do this or that? And each one of them, because now you've separated yourself, each one of them requires a new, you know, message essentially. So it's fairly time consuming. It's fairly mentally straining, but if you do it properly, it will compound on itself, I think.
Yeah. It's really, I think, important to get that. And plus you get the feedback, right? You're tweaking a product. It's been pretty awesome. And so then the manufacturing, right? Of course, you said earlier it's your first time into China, and I think you guys are on, it seems like you're doing the right things. Sometimes Kickstarter guys have trouble, and can you talk about your process, how you, your confidence of your manufacturing?
Yeah, I backed my first Kickstarter project in 2010 or 11, I think. So I had taken an interest in Kickstarter for a while. I actually wanted to start my own Kickstarter site for a long time. That was back when it was probably still possible to have a competitor to Kickstarter. And now it's like, all right, what's the best way to game Kickstarter essentially? You can learn a lot from other people's failures on Kickstarter, primarily failure to deliver or delays in delivering hardware. And that was what I was always most interested in. When I first started learning about it, I was really just learning about it from reading and kind of studying it in case studies and things like that. And as I learned about it, I was interested in these processes that people were getting held up on. So like molding is a huge thing, you know, making sure the product fits together and works. And then also sourcing high quality components and things like that is very important. So as I started looking into this, it was right around the time that I started working at a makerspace, like working out of a makerspace and just getting hands-on first-person experience with these tools and these techniques and things that are going to build your product. So I would say, like, before setting a goal for yourself of how much you want to raise for this product or even what the product's name is, like, understand what it's going to take to build it. And if you do that, it's going to make the process of building it that much easier. So when we got out here, we were under the full impression that if you give your whole manufacturing to someone to build for you, that's a very vulnerable position to be in, because now you're having to convince them that this needs to be this way because of that. Whereas they don't see it like that. They see it as a cost thing, right? Especially here in China, and this is what we've learned, is that it's all about cost for them, even though for you, you might be willing to pay 20 extra cents to get high quality, but they wouldn't even think about that. They would first go for the low quality, you know, low cost. So what we did was we broke our product down into its bare components. So we said, all right, we need to find solar panels. We need to find batteries. We need to find circuit boards, and we need to find shells. How do we go about doing each one of those? And then finding secure cables and finding all those things that were essentially out in the market already. So a really deep understanding of your product is, I couldn't more highly recommend it, but our product, that being said, like, our product isn't that complicated when it comes down to it. Some people have the extra layer of software on top of it. Now, I can't offer any direct experience from integrating hardware and software, but I can just tell you that it's exponentially harder. So understand what you're doing on the software side, or have someone on the team that does. Understand the hardware side, or have somebody on the team that does. And then as the founder, you need to bridge that gap between those two. You need to understand how these changes in software are going to affect your hardware, and how your hardware changes are going to affect your software. And that's usually what I've seen. That's how people on Kickstarter get tripped up, and they get delayed and delayed and delayed, because either they know a lot about the software and not enough about the hardware, or they know a lot about the hardware and not enough about the software. So something always ends up being like, they're always dragging the other piece behind them, and it just compiles and piles and piles on top of them. Before they know it, they're, you know, a year behind schedule and don't have a working prototype again, you know? So that's a really strong point as well, is having a working prototype by the time that you go to manufacture it. I think Cyril from Hackcelerator says it perfectly, is that, you know, they always talk about lean startup, you know, lean startup being no business plan will survive, you know, an MVP or something like that. And then for hardware, it's no product will survive a factory. Meaning you can think that you have an idea of what this product is going to be, but once you take it to a manufacturer, they're going to change every little thing about it. So if you can jump ahead of that and kind of get to the point where you know what they're going to change, and change it ahead of schedule, and say to them, look, we're doing this for a reason, not just because that's how our working prototype worked, that's going to get you closer to actually not getting tripped up in manufacturing. So
I would also say that in manufacturing, like, a lot of people go into it with confidence, and I would almost argue against doing that. I would say go into it with a little bit of skepticism, because to Jason's point, like, if you don't know your product, you're going to get tripped up. Even if you do know your product and you're super confident about that, you may have no idea how it needs to be, like, manufactured or designed for a manufacturable piece that replicates or that can be produced in mass quantities.
You guys do a really good job, and like Marcel says, you know, I've seen one of your emails. You have really good communicating to your backers, and that's really important, is communication too. So you've been doing a great job. And also, you say you're like open source. You like tell all the parts. Maybe you can expand on that idea.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to be open source. I'm trying to make this as open source of a hardware product as possible, for multiple reasons. First of all, this is the first iteration of the product. There's people out there that are way more intelligent and way more clever and brilliant than we are, than even the people that we have on this team. So it's my belief that if I were to release my designs, that people would make them better to my benefit. Meaning, you know, you might have an idea for how to make the circuit better, or you might have an idea of how to make the shell better. And if I just give you the basic building blocks of that, then you'll help build the product, right? Kind of like Arduino, but with less software. And this is going to start getting more critical to our business model once we do incorporate software, because a company that just thinks that they can innovate by themselves forever is, I would say, in some ways deluding themselves. Whereas if you just open your product up and are honest and open with people as far as what you're putting into it and why, people will give you criticism and feedback that might make it better in the future. And the other reason is, I just don't see anyone else doing this with a product like ours. And maybe there's a reason for that, but I guess that's the line that we're walking at this point. I just feel like I value that. So I feel like there's other people that would value that. And even if you don't value it, there's no harm to you to having that information accessible, especially with the shells, right? Like, I think our shell looks fine, but there's some people that think it looks too big, and there's some people that think it looks too small. So what I would challenge them to do is redesign it, and we'll build it. You know, but I'm not going to redesign it, because I think it looks good the way it looks. So to the open source point, I think it just comes down to, we want that to be part of our brand, and we don't want to build something that people don't want. So if enough people are telling us that something should be built, then we'll do it, or we'll try our best to do it. And there's always, you know, to the communication point, and I know Dave can probably speak on this as well, like, we try, but it's really hard to be completely open and transparent and always communicative. But that being said, a lot of people don't even try. So we just feel like even if we're just trying our best, that should suffice. And it seems to be working so far.
And to highlight, I think Jason makes a really good point about the open source model and how not a lot of people are doing that for reasons of fear, for reasons of complacency, for a multitude of reasons, right? But one thing I think that we've noticed collaboratively as a team is that, you know, boldness doesn't seem to be fashionable, nor does it seem to be something that people lean towards, right? But there's a lot to be said for that. When you're bold in the marketplace to stand against what has normally been done, not only is that a differentiation factor, but that's also just a statement factor. That's a character factor, right? If you want to build a brand or a company, I think it deserves or at least warrants you to be bold, to do something different, because it gets to the point where if you're going to do the same things that everyone else has done, are you building anything, or are you just hammering the same things that have been hammered before, a nail deeper into the same piece of wood? And I think with that boldness comes some trust you have to have just in your consumers to say, hey, we believe in this, but it's worth it at the end of the day.
I would say one more thing to the open source part. I think a huge reason why I made it open source was largely upfront. I had this idea for what it could be, and it was in my mind, and I was like, look, it's going to be like this. It's going to be like this. And as people would tell me things, I very subconsciously but actively blocked that out of my mind to keep it, this is what it's going to be. This is what it's going to be. And what I found is as soon as I started opening my mind to new ideas of people giving me criticism and feedback, the product started to take shape, and the product started to become real, and the product started to be, you know, actually exist. And that's more important to me than, you know, thinking of something and making it exactly like that. I just want to make something that people want and ultimately that I feel is valuable too. So what I found was that the more people that would tell me ideas, oh, why don't you have this? Why don't you have that? It's like, that's a beautiful idea. Why don't we have that? I don't think it's going to be in this product, but why couldn't it be in the next product? You know, put it together, you know, make it understandable for me, and then we'll work on it. You know, I think there's a serious lack in the marketplace of a repository for ideas for products. You know, I think there are businesses like, let's say Quirky, for example, right? Like that's their whole business model, is open it up and we'll build whatever you guys think needs to be built. Well, I kind of want it to be the same way, which is like, oh, you think you want a lighter on yours. You want yours to be a USB drive. You want, those are all, and being here in Shenzhen, it's so understandable and so like readily apparent that all these things that people are telling me that they think is like a crazy idea is doable overnight. But it just needs to be, we need to be aware of that. So who am I to shut people's ideas down? This company should be the one to open up to ideas and say, what do you think should exist? You know, and then let's just kick this around, because that's how innovation happens, I feel like, right? It's not just one person who thinks of something and then builds it. It's the culmination of a lot of different ideas and a lot of different thoughts and, you know, all building into one creation.
Great answer, guys. And I guess it's also a combination of like listening to your user, lean startup, open source,
like a feedback loop. And I think that's important, right? That's something that more so than our technology, more so than a patent, I want the feedback loop to be our competitive advantage, right? What makes you different? Well, we build products that people haven't even thought of, or people that they just thought of this. So what might take a company 2 years in research and development and market testing to build, well, we do it in reverse. We have people thinking of these ideas and saying, oh, we want this, and then we build it. You know, and it kind of starts with Spore, but in reality, I think the open source model is really going to come into play with like attachments and things that people want to see this used for. So a lot of people ask us, you know, what does this product do? Well, I have an idea of what this product will do for me, but you tell me what you use it for. You know, what do you power with this product? What kind of applications are you finding for this product? And once I see that, as long as we're willing to like listen to that, I feel like it's gonna come to the point where we're building solutions to problems that are just existing. You know, that people are the very forefront people, the people that are experimenting with Arduinos, the people that are the hackers, the innovators, those are the people that are gonna be looking to us to say, we want this built. And once that gets built, you know, once those early adopters then see that, once it catches on to the mainstream, like we can hopefully create a business model around this, essentially.
That's really kind of goes into my next question, is like the future plans for Spore. Mm-hmm. Maybe just I know it's probably a lot, but maybe some
just a few things, I guess. the Spore as a company is really an energy company more so than just a consumer device company. So I think branching into larger scale solar, but keeping the philosophy of simplicity and ease of use, because that's something that I see as a fault in the market for solar right now, is that it's still really expensive and because it's still very complicated. And it's very complicated because the systems are very large and the installation processes are complicated and the permitting process is a nightmare. So why don't we just hook USB ports to these things and just allow people to plug into them whenever they want? You know, it sounds like a crazy idea and it sounds very simple, but no one's doing it necessarily. So I think that's kind of what we're focused on mostly, is stepping up the solar side of it. So that's like more on the generation side. And then, you know, why not USB wind? Why not USB hydro or thermal or anything, you know? And then the other side of that is, like I mentioned to you before, was what are you using this product for? Or what can this product be used for? So you have this generation, you have this storage, which would be, I guess, you know, we could go upscale. We could build 12 volt versions. We can build 24, 48 volt versions. So you could just strap it to a bike and make it an electric bike. I mean, that's one thing we've noticed about China is how many electric bikes there are around here. And then, so now you have the storage, but what about the use? Let's start coming up with uses that are either already existent, but make them easier, cheaper, open source, simpler, or uses that haven't really been, no one really thought to make USB, right? Now you're seeing a lot of USB speakers. You're starting to see a lot of USB this and that and this. Well, who's making them, right? They all seem kind of cheap. They all seem kind of like of low quality. Well, let's take those ideas and make them quality, or let's take ideas that haven't really happened before and then make them USB, or, you know, they exist, but they're not low powered. So I think now we're catching on to this wave of low powered devices. Like our devices, for example, are low powered. Our phones are low powered. Could you ever imagine powering a computer, you know, 10 years ago, even from USB? Well, what I'm saying is that's right around the corner, powering laptops, powering, you know, TVs, powering all this stuff directly via USB. So now it's like, well, what's USB? Let's start creating these USB devices that are going to be like the new wave of things almost.
I didn't get my degree in fortune telling, so I don't know what the future of Spore is, but I can tell you what in a nutshell what I would like it to be or desire it to be. And that's, I would desire for us to have the best quality ears in the world to take a step back and just listen to what our consumers are saying, what our investors are saying, what our partners are saying, but then have the solidarity to move in a very strategic direction based off of our core principles. But first, to just be able to listen and just say, hey, everybody, we hear what you're saying and we're working towards it.
You guys are definitely really great at listening, and I think it's going to definitely help you succeed long term. Maybe some advice you'd give for other hardware entrepreneurs thinking to come out here and get to Kickstarter or fund their projects?
We're kind of a unique example because we're not engineers. So I think if you're, you know, like a business person or a creative person or anything like that, just put in the time and the mental energy and effort to really understand what goes into engineering, what goes into manufacturing, what it takes to build a product. And on the flip side of that, if you're an engineer, spend the time understanding what it takes to build a good company and build a good brand, because I don't think either one can create a successful, maybe you can create a successful Kickstarter, but it's not really about that. And I think that's an important point to call out right now, is that we looked at this early on, not as launching a Kickstarter. We looked at it as launching a business, and more to the point, not even just launching a product, but launching, you know, a brand, something that was more and was going to live on beyond just this 30-day campaign, right? A lot of people get this idea that it's all about this campaign, all about this campaign. And I'm sure we had those same thoughts, but if you're going into it just to make money on Kickstarter, get out now. Get into it because you feel like this thing needs to exist, or get into it because you feel like you want this to happen, or get in because you feel like no one else is doing it and you recognize a need that should be there. Like, it should exist in the world that we all experience, right? Coming specifically to coming out here, have things lined up, right? Like, have your production somewhat understood. So like for our product, we broke it down into the components. So we understood very clearly that all of our components were coming from China. Do you know that all your components are coming from China? And if so, you know, do you know enough about those components to be able to sort out the good manufacturers from the bad manufacturers? Be able to do it by yourself and try and keep as much control over the building of your product as possible. Not saying that you can't involve other parties, because you know there's value to that, involving people that know more about a certain thing or can source a certain thing or can ship or export your product in a way that you can't. But make sure that you're overseeing all of it, because I think specifically engineers, like, they'll get tied into the building of the product and not really understand the implications of building a brand behind that product, because how you build it is going to reflect on who people are buying it from, kind of thing. And I'm sure I'll have some more, but
I would say to drop your ego, in a sense. You're going to run into challenges, and you need not to let those you don't need to let those challenges make you feel bad about yourself. I would also say, in the context of going to manufacturing, don't be so caught up in yourself that you lose sight of, one, who that product's ultimately for, and two, how experienced manufacturers can benefit you. So that's a huge one. But I also think having, like, a good team to work with is very core and very fundamental. Because if you don't, and you're in it by yourself, or you're in it with a team that is a little questionable, you're not only going to shoot yourself in the foot, but you're going to want to stab yourself in your other foot afterwards. And I'm not saying that from experience, because I've had, like, a great team to work with and to be a part of. I'm saying that from seeing other people stab themselves in their other foot after they shot themselves in the first one. But the most significant thing I think I can say is prepare. Prepare beforehand. Do not rush. Right? You don't want to be the team or the campaign or the business that doesn't think through things and just does. I think there's a lot to say about acting and having actionable items, but those items need to be rooted in a very intelligent thought, right? Do work intelligently. Don't just do without thinking and preparing months, not a month, but months before your Kickstarter needs to launch, or your business needs to launch, because that'll get you the PR you need, the marketing you need, the backers you need, all in terms of preparation. And I would also drop your ego on that too, because if you're afraid of work and reaching out to people via email or calling them up and things of that nature 3 months beforehand or a month beforehand, go home.
One more thing to that point. Try to under promise and over deliver as much as you can, because it's very easy on Kickstarter to get yourself in the idea that this thing needs to be so mind blowing and so out there and crazy that people just want to buy it right then. Well, that could very well be great, but it could more likely blow up in your face, because now you raised $500,000 and have physically no way. Not only do you not know how to do it, but no one in the world knows how to do it at the price, with the technology, or anything the way that you promised it. So now you've put, super, super high expectations in people's heads, and therefore anything lower than that is going to be a failure. So I would say look into kind of just making a very bare version of it first. And maybe you don't go to Kickstarter with that. Maybe the next version is what you go to Kickstarter with, but certainly don't add in technologies that you don't fully comprehend. And it goes back to my point before of just really knowing what you're building. And you don't have to know every piece of it. Like, for example, you don't know how this mold is going to be made. Like, there's manufacturers that can do that, rest assured in that stuff. But especially when it comes down to interfacing hardware and software, be careful and just do what you know you can do or are close to knowing that you can do. So that's what I'd say.
Oh, really great advice, guys. Those are my main points for today. And I'm sure there's tons more, and people might want to reach out to you. Unfortunately, successfully, you had a successful Kickstarter, so it's closed. It's not open now, but maybe you can leave websites or tweet Twitter accounts or whatever ways people can reach out to you.
Yeah, definitely. We're more than happy to answer questions, talk to people about Kickstarter. If you want to learn more about the project, if you want to learn more about the Kickstarter project or our website, or even go on and order, we have a pre-sale site up. You just go to sporechargers.com. That's S-P-O-R, chargers.com. Or you can get in contact with us. I'll leave my email address, and that's just david@sporechargers.com.
Great, guys. That's a wrap. And enjoy the rest of your trip. Hopefully we hang out some more in China.
Definitely. Thank awesome. You. Well, yeah. Thank you.
We'll be back. We'll be back. Thank you, Mike.
All right, great. Thank you, Jason and David. Thanks for sharing. You guys are really upbeat and determined with a great vision, and I'm really excited to see you keeping your progression going. Also, thanks to Marcel in Hong Kong. He's the one that connected us. He's a backer of their project, and it was pretty awesome for him to think to connect me when they were sending updates that they were in China. So we made that happen. And also, I know that David and Jason told me they extended their trip in China already by a week. So it's pretty funny how, you know, it kind of makes me think a little bit of what I went through when I first came here. I'm sure they'll be back soon and gonna follow their progress. It's also amazing how crowdfunding has really changed the world. You know, in Global from Asia, I feel like I'm mixing up a little bit these projects and case studies with more of the corporate, financial, and banking stuff. I just don't want to get too boring with just talking about banking and merchant accounts and accounting. So, you know, I hope you guys like it. I love any feedback from listeners, what kind of topics you like. I have so many backlogged already, and more I'm even doing while I have that backlog. I'm loving this stuff. So next week, I'm going to pick a show we did. It's about time I get it to be released. It's how to import into China. Well, not exactly how to import into China, but how to export from America. We have two American government representatives that are sharing with us incentives from the American government to sell American goods internationally to, you know, kind of get the economy of America selling more products abroad. And there's a lot of interesting programs and even events that are coming up that they're really looking for people to help. And it doesn't just mean American citizens. It can be anybody, Chinese, European, anywhere. If you're selling American products abroad, they want to help you and they have some programs. So I think it's a good one to get out soon. All right. See you guys next week and enjoy your week. Bye-bye.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.